let's see. So it started with an attempt to steal postdocs and researchers from here. I'll tell you why in a minute. And then I'm going to give you an outline of domains and measurement, and then how domains arise in general relativity, and how they arise in quantum mechanics, and then what this talk is really about, which is the intersection of those two. So the first thing is this sort of like part of my pitch for postdocs. I am seriously looking for students and researchers and postdocs. Some of you know this. So we have an informatic phenomena group at NRL that has broad interests, right? Now, NRL gets some of its money from a place called ONR, right? They're sort of in charge of all the Navy funding, and they recently started a $6 million program with a call of topics, things like relativistic quantum information, categorical quantum mechanics, like very, like, you know, like sort of abstract things, good things, you know. So I'm looking for researchers and students that have a healthy disregard for convention, you know. And I know some people that are influential in the right way. And so, you know, any interested parties should send an email here. Or if you just have information about an interesting party, you could send that along as well. So about the postdocs, I'd like to put domain theory and measurement and physics, right, the application of it to physics, in context. And it was a weird way I did this about like 5 years ago. So I was an angry, starving postdoc working in a really obscure area, right? And I came up with a way to explain my position in the universe to everybody. So if there's a postdoc sort of feels this way, you're the person I want to give a job to. So start off like this. It's sort of rage against your community stuff. Well, one of the things people with no emotions do is science. One of the areas of science that isn't really science is computer science. The part of any science that no one respects is called theory. The part of theory that the theorists don't respect is called track B. The part of track B near extinction is called semantics. And the part of semantics that is extinct is known as domain theory. Now, the fringe element in domain theory is called measurement. And the part of measurement for people who need medication is called the analysis of informatic phenomena. There are about 5 people in this community, but only one would admit it in public. And their consensus on the work I'm about to show you was something like this. As I read this paper, an excerpt from Blake's Auguries of Innocence came to mind. To see a world in grain of sand, except without the world, and not quite a complete grain of sand, but only part of one, part of the grain is not interesting. And at that time, the silver lining was, ta-da, I was a postdoc, right? So if you're looking at the world and it sort of looks to you like this, please send me an email. About domains and measurement. So, domains are partially ordered sets with an unusual amount of structure, right? There's an information order, and when I say a partially ordered set, it's reflexive, it's transitive, and it's anti-symmetric, okay? But it has a lot of other properties, too. Now, I'm giving you this up front, its intuition is valuable. So, if x is below y, then we say y is more informative than x. That's one way to think of it, all right? Another way to think of it is y is more defined or it's more certain, okay? Or we can say x carries information about y. These are all sort of intuitions, right? Now, some elements within this universe are total in that they're maximally informative. So they have the property that if anything is above them, it is them, and that's it, right? Those are called maximal. So some intuition here, really quick, just think of mixed states, okay? You know, pure states will be maximal because they're sort of maximally informative if you had an order on them, right? And the completely mixed state would be the least element, right? This will be like bottom, and that's what bottom is. I think it's below everything. All right, it's just an intuition right now, but later.
What did you mean by an order being anti-symmetric? I didn't understand.
It means that if x is below y and y is below x, then they're equal.
Oh,
okay. All right. Now they have an intrinsic notion of completeness, right? And here's what it means. If you have an increasing sequence of elements, right, so x1, x2, and information increases, it has a limit, all right, which is like represented by a supremum that's a least upper bound, right? So everybody knows what the least upper bound is, right? Okay. So now they also come with a notion of approximation, which is derived from the order. All right, and I'm going to define it in a minute. But if we write that, then we say x approximates y. All right. Or another way to think of it is x doesn't just carry information about y, but it carries essential information about y. All right. That's another view. And then the part that I added to domain theory, the fringe element, is the quantitative aspect. To each informative object X, a measurement assigns information content, you know, right, of X. It's a number. And we'll say more about that in a minute. One of the surprises here, though, is that domain theoretically, if you ask what information content is, then solving that problem is the same as figuring out what degree of approximation is. Like classically, meaning like in classical mathematics, computer science, that idea makes no sense at all. You know, but here, it's because of the unusual structure of domains. Those coincide. So now, about completeness in more detail, right? So I mentioned that, you know, they have to be directly complete, okay? They have to have a notion of completeness. And what it means is that every directed set is a soup, right? Now, like, I don't really care about directed sets because they're, like, abstract and they're complicated. So I like to think of them as just being increasing sequences, right? But... And it turns out, in every application of physics, you can think of a directed set as being an increase in sequence, right? The reason we care about completeness is that if you have a function which is Scott continuous on a domain with the least element, say like a completely mixed state, then it has a least fixed point. That's something that you actually do with completeness. And just as sort of a thing to later, I'll actually show you this weird abstract nonsense captures the maximum entropy state, right, as an example. Right. So Scott continuity here is written order theoretically. Right. It has to be monotone. So if x is below y, then f of x is below f of y, and it has to commute with the soup operator. Right. This means preserve limits. If you apply the function to a limit, it's the same as taking the limit of the function practice. Right. This is familiar. Right. That's completeness. Approximation is a little bit harder to explain. Right. One way to think of it is like this. Right. Any path to y or beyond must pass through x. See? You know, so here actually, like, it's sort of helpful to think of light cones. Okay? And when would x approximate y? So if this was x and y was in the future of x, right? Then when would x approximate y? When any path that you take to y or beyond has to get above x. Like, you can't get to y without getting above x. So that's one way to think of it. It turns out that for reasons only to really figure out, this really does capture what it means, you know, to have essential information about something. Because every increasing sequence or every directed set that you take to an element, you know, is really like a way of approaching it. So in computation, it's a way of computing. All right? Like in physics, it sort of corresponds to the process by which a mixed state might like move up, right? Might change some. And we call it a postulate set continuous when every element can be written as the limit of its finite approximations, right? Which we call finite approximations. These, right here, just these are difficult axioms to satisfy, right? But we'll actually see that there's like a lot more structure than this in physics. So I want to give you an example. This talk is like really driven by examples, right? I think in general that the structure of domains really is something that physics should know about. This example, by the way, if you understand this, then understanding the causal structure of space-time is, I mean, you can do tons of things just by thinking about the real line, right? So we take the compact intervals of the real line, right? So those are line segments that start at A and end at B, right? And we order them by reverse inclusion. So to move up in this order means, if you're here, then to move up means to pick out a subinterval like this, right? And this was originally introduced for real number computation because, you know, if you have a large interval that contains, like, the root to an equation, right, then moving up means you have more information, right, because the interval gets smaller, right? Well, then, so how do you take the soup or the limit of a directed set? It's the intersection of all the intervals, right? What does approximation mean? Well, it means that not only is CD contained, right, in AB, but that it's contained in the interior, you see? See, if CD is in the interior of AB, then any path to it has to actually get above AB. If it's not, then it might be equal at some endpoint, and then it doesn't have to be, right? And then it has a countable basis, which we don't care too much about. Another example is majorization, right? So if we restrict majorization to monotone states, right, where the probabilities decrease, then you get a continuous DCPO, and there the least element is Bob. Right? I mean, it's 1 over n, 1 of the uniform distribution. These are some facts about majorization, but I'm assuming everybody here has heard of it, right?
The least element is what? What did you call it?
I call it bottom, but it's bottom. Yeah, the uniform distribution, yeah. And, I mean, so I'm assuming you know these things, but it actually has this giant history, like, you know, for 100 years ago, but it has some really amazing things I find amazing anyway, uses in quantum information. So if you might want to look it up. Like Michael Nielsen did a lot of work on connecting majorization of quantum packets. So that's another example. And sort of if we take that idea actually, so you know that like maybe you know one of the theorems on local operations of classical communication, right? And you ask how does the state of a bipartite system change, right? And you can write out you can basically write out a classical probability distribution, right? You know whose entropy like captures the degree of entanglement, right? And then you ask like how can the entanglement transform from one state to the other, right? How can it change on the local operations of classical communication? And it turns out that those classical distributions have to compare in majorization. Like that's one of Nielsen's like great results, I think. Well, anyway, in that context, these functions arise that you care about called entanglement monotones, right? And if you use classical, finite probability distributions to measure the entanglement, right, of a bipartite system, for pure state, then what you care about are having functions defined on classical probability distributions that are what they call entanglement monotones, right? So the point of that long thing is that entanglement monotones are exactly Scott continuous functions with respect to the majorization domain, okay? So that's one way to think of Scott continuity. Now, I defined Scott continuity earlier as an order theoretic idea, right? But the reason it's called Scott continuity is because it can also be characterized topologically. And what we do is we go back to the approximations, which if you want, you can think of as the light cones with no boundary, for instance. That's really what they're like, right? But those sets, just by themselves, form a basis for a topology called the Scott topology, right? And continuity with respect to that topology is an order theoretic thing. It means if x is below y, then f of x is below f of y, and f preserves soups, right? And like I said, a good example of a Scott continuous map is an entanglement monotone. We'll actually see that the Lorentz distance is another example later.
So why is this stronger notion of this double less than relevant in this entanglement case?
I don't know, actually, that it is. I mean, we can prove that it is because you need the approximation to give you Scott continuity to tell you what entanglement monotone is. But, I don't actually, know of a, I mean, other than that, we, this pretty much is, that's what you use approximation really to define as a Scott topology. But, I mean, it would be better to have a stronger connection, right, just between the relation itself, right? I mean, we could write out the definition, probably. All right, so what do we see? The completeness, right, the approximation. And now I'm going to mention the quantitative one, right? So a measurement, and again, we're being informal here, but in a minute I'm not going to be, assigns to every informative object a number which measures the information content of the object. So let's, here's what we're looking for. We're looking for, a mathematical definition, right, that will basically, in part, separate functions that are just nice with respect to the order from those that measure information content. And when I say information content, I'm talking about the particular context defined by the order. The idea is that every time you have an order, you have an implicit qualitative idea about what it means to be more informative. And we're looking for functions that measure information content in that sense, right? So one thing is this, right? See, I've written it with a star. That's the dual order. It means if you move up in the order, uncertainty should decrease. That's one thing that says. The second thing is that if you have a process and it converges, then the content of the output is the limit, the content of stages, right? That's just what Scott continuity means, right? Now, if we just took a constant function on a domain, it would have those properties, right? So that can't be the only story to content. One of the things that I stumbled across in my thesis was that if you ask a different question, which is a question from computation, and the question basically is, how do you define degree of approximation? It gives you this axiom, which I'll be happy to show you guys later if you want. But the point is, the axiom actually seems to, in part, separate functions that measure information content on a domain from those that are just nice. All right. So the point is, there's an extra property that a function needs to satisfy. Minimally, there's an extra property. And this is it. So a Scott continuous meter is to measure the content of some element. All right. If whenever you have an element
Scott Open set, then all the epsilon approximations are also in the set.
Now, there are a couple ways you can say this. Remember what a Scott Open set is, like a typical one, is it's a light cone with no boundary, right? We can think of these if we want, like in certain contexts, as an observation about X. So one thing to say is that mu is measuring the content of an element when every observation about X is also an observation about its epsilon approximations. And the catch, though, is that epsilon approximation is in part defined by mu. You see? This is what's making mu measure content. This is one of the indications that a function is. Another way to look at it is, literally, it's kind of like taking the domain and thinking of it as a bunch of points, and then taking this function, even though it's only defined on one object, and treating it as a metric. And then this is like the epsilon ball, right? And basically what you're saying here is you want to generate the Scott topology, which is the topology of the light numbers, right? There are a lot of ways to look at it, but I'd rather like show you like some examples and the kind of things you can do with it.
Can you just went back to your question? What was mu? How did you define mu sub x?
Yeah. So these are the things that are below x, right? And are epsilon close to x. You see what I mean? And so there are lots of functions that can't do this. And I have a great example. If you just promise not to get bored with all the math, I swear, right? I have a really, really good example in relativity of the difference between a function that is a measurement and one that's not. And I think you're going to like it. Because I like it, damn it. Yeah. Right?
But it sounds like time is just some time in some frame.
All right, you know what? Don't ruin my thing. you know, if you're smart, you can have to sit outside. All right. Yeah. All right. So this axiom we can think about some. And it is worth thinking about. It is a serious pain in the ass trying to verify this axiom. It was for about 6 years, okay, until me and my friend Prakash at McGill proved this theorem that makes it easy. And now it's easy. It used to be really easy in computer science and impossible in physics, but now it's actually easy in physics. I'll be happy to show you that too. It's not as fun. But it is a bit of a mystery, this axiom, but you'll see from examples that it separates things. And it can be explained, by the way. I just have chosen not to really explain it. So here are some properties measurements have, right? If the measure of an element is zero, right, then that means that there's no uncertainty in the element, right? And if there's no uncertainty, it means it's maximally informative. So it's maximal. So that follows from that weird axiom, okay? Here's another one. If you have two objects and they're comparable, meaning two objects and one contains information about the other, and their contents are equal, then they're equal. See? All right. The third one connects the study of measurement to the Scott topology. And it basically tells you, right, that using order and using mu, you can reconstruct the Scott topology. And if you're familiar with like causality in relativity, you know that like, I don't know if you know, but you can use a global time function and the order, right, to derive a topology. But what you can't use is the Lorentz distance in the order, right? And what I'm trying to say is that analogy is more than an analogy, actually. All that's an instance of this. That's really what this statement says. Right? So we have these properties. These properties are valuable. They let us actually define things, all right, like the informatic derivative. So let me show you this one. If we have a process which is represented by a function in the domain, right, then we can define its informatic derivative at p in this way. So let me tell you what this means. So first, this is a limit taken in a topology that's defined by the order. All right? Intuitively, what it means is you're below p, and you want to get arbitrarily close to p, right? And the closer you get to p, you want to calculate this number, and then you want that sequence of numbers to have a limit. Right? That's what this means. But what I want to point out to you is, remember, the measurement axiom gave a strict monotonicity, right? If x is below y and they're not equal, then their measures aren't equal, right? And look what that does here. It means you're not dividing by zero. So that property, that comparable objects with the same content are equal, allows you to define the derivative, right? And now, as a simple example, suppose you took a function from the reals to the reals, right? You could extend it to the interval domain, right, by passing the images, right? So like if you have f, you know, if you have a function like this, okay, you know, how would you get some function, you know, from the interval domain to the interval domain, right? And what we do is say, well, all right, when I have this interval, right, I'm going to do this, and then by continuity, I know I would get an integral. It would be compact and connected, right? You see? So every function like this can be represented as a Scott continuous function in this domain, right? So now you look at this function, right? And you take the length measurement, because length is a measurement on the integral domain. And then you ask, what's the informatic derivative at a maximal element, right? And then it works out to basically be the derivative, okay? And you can actually capture C1 functions in this way. Now, that's a classical example, but there are a lot of informatic derivatives that have no classical counterpart. I'm going to show you one later. It's marvelously simple. But these are informatic derivatives that exist because they're functions on domains that have informatic rates of change. They are not classical derivatives. You know, they just never could be. And it even happened in numerical analysis, which is sort of funny. there's also a discrete derivative. You don't actually need to have this limit process that I talked about. You can take this at isolated points, but that's not in the talk. So once
I forgot what mu was.
Oh, sorry, where?
Is that definition of the derivative?
Oh, mu is a measurement on the domain. Oh. So we have a domain, we have a measurement. The thing that satisfies the axiom.
Maybe you go back again because I haven't seen this, it might be nice just to clarify that once more.
Okay, so this is mu. It's a Scott continuous map that satisfies this axiom. Yeah? And so once we have, so first we start off with a domain, so it's a collection of objects with a qualitative idea about information in order, right? Then we have a measurement, which measures the content of the objects. And then once we have those two, we prove that the measurement has properties that we care about, and those properties enable us to define a derivative.
And mathematically, what is it? Is it a map of the domain into itself?
Yes, that's what it is. Yep, it maps the domain into the domain of non-negative reals ordered upside down. So the fact that they're ordered upside down means that as you move up.
I see. Oh, so that's the one that's like, I mean, the distinction between, maybe I'm just getting mixed up, but just, you had a mu and you had an f.
Mm-hmm.
So what was?
Okay, where's the f? Oh, you mean right here?
Oh, I see. This is the f is an arbitrary function. Scott continuous function.
No, just function.
An arbitrary function.
Yeah.
And by the way, I'm trying to compute its derivative.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And let me just say another thing about this too. These domains don't have to be the same. I just took them like that because I'm basically lazy when I make slides and I don't want to get into like details and whatever, right? But these can be two different domains. Right? And then up here in the y part, you have a different measurement. Right? So you have one measurement here and one measurement here. Right? And that's what it measures, right? It's the content of the output against the content of the input. Right? And this was, like I said, all this in the abstract, this was all used like to do computation, right? Initially. So there are plenty of examples of this thing I mentioned, which is that there are informatic derivatives that have no classical counterpart, but don't worry, I'm not going to bore you with anything from computer science. So once you have this derivative, what can you do? Right? I just want to give you an idea, because these are relevant today. Remember I mentioned before that Scott continuous maps have least fixed points? And that was one of the reasons we care about completeness, right? Well, once you have a measurement, what you learn is that maps don't have to be continuous to have fixed points, right? Only the measures have to be continuous, right? So you don't really need to know that f is continuous just its measure. I mean, you need to know another thing instead, but the point is you can strictly like generalize the fixed point theorem by paying attention to the manner in which it exchanges information, right? And then if you had such a fixed point, which could be calculated by beginning at bottom and iterating and taking a limit, if you had one like that, then by taking its informatic derivative at this point, you measure the rate at which the function converges to a fixed point, right? And so in computer science, you know, this allows you to basically calculate the complexity of an algorithm that's calculating by iterating, right? And then another thing you can do, and this is sort of counterintuitive because measurements are only defined on one parameter, they have one parameter, but you can actually use them to define a metric, and I'll put metric in quotes, because the Scott topology, by the way, is never Hausdorff. So it can't be given by a metric that satisfies the three axioms, but it satisfies generalizations of those axioms. But you can use this one, you know, parameter function to define a two-parameter one. So the point is, you can derive distance from content, which is a sort of surprise. So I want to show you an example, actually, of the last one. So here's a binary channel, right? And so everybody's seen this, right? You, 0 gets flipped with some probability A, and 1 gets flipped with some probability B, right? Or 1 minus A, I like. So that's a binary channel, which we can represent as a point in the unit square, right? Now, if we want to measure the correlation between the input and the output, right, when stuff passes through this channel, that's the capacity. So you get it by souping the mutual information. If you want, you know, you can be stupid like me, and you can calculate this and wish that you had it, right? And it works out to be this, and this is where H is the binary entropy. And it's symmetric, right? So because it is, if we want, we can assume that all channels are non-negative, meaning just that A is greater than or equal to B. Right? What that really corresponds to is a positive correlation between the input and the output. So, but let's just do it. Right? Now, suppose you wanted to order binary channels to get a domain of binary channels. Right? One thing you could do is you could look at the probability of error. Right? So T is the probability that 0 gets sent, and this is the probability of an error occurring. And then you could say, well, I'll say that channel X is below channel Y if the probability of error increases for all possible input distributions. Right? Well, if you do that, you get a continuous DCPO that turns capacity into a measurement. Right? But check it out. It actually is isomorphic to the interval domain over the unit interval. So you remember the construction of the interval domain. Just take the intervals and order them. Well, this order is actually just the interval domain again. Right? Now, here's the deep part. If you have all that, one of the things you know is that since capacity is a measurement, that it gives you the Scott topology on the whole domain, right? And in particular, along the top, right? So here's the domain of channels, which is isomorphic to this thing, right? So we can, if we want, we can draw it like this, as a triangle, okay? Now, right here are 0 capacity channels, or 1-point intervals, and right here is the identity channel, or the entire interval. And we're looking at sub-intervals now, right? Now, if I have, like, some x, what does it mean to move up in order? If this is x, it means I have to move within this triangle. All right? That's what the order winds up meaning. All right? So that's what it looks like. Now, capacity is a function, right? And it takes a channel into some number between 0 and 1. Now, it's got a couple of properties, right? The first one we already made use of. It's symmetric, right? Another one is that if the capacity of some channel is 0, then that means that A and B are equal, right? All right. Now, if you're looking at those, maybe what you're thinking is those look like some of the axioms of a metric, right? Like a normal, like Riemannian type metric, right? Here's the thing. There's no triangle inequality here, right? You can prove there's no triangle inequality. But if you consider the epsilon balls of this capacity function, it generates the Euclidean topology. Right? And we know this because capacity is a measurement. That's one of the things it tells us. Right? This is like a ridiculous and crazy result, really. Right? So if we look at these balls, right, we say, okay, you know, how do I measure the distance between points? Well, if I measure this between x and y, I form some channel, which I can conceptually think of as being a channel to use to communicate, and then I take the capacity of it. I'll have a notion of distance. It'll satisfy this and this. It will have no triangle inequality, but I won't change my notion of topology or limit at all. I'll still get the usual Euclidean topology. Right? That's an application of measurement that I enjoy, because once you know that you can do this with the unit interval, you can do it with the products of the unit interval. And if you can do it with the products of the unit interval, right, you can do it locally in a manifold, and then you can begin to wonder about very weird things. But anyway, that's not really the point of the slide so much as it is the reappearance of the interval domain, right? It came up again, and, you know, and there's no way I meant for that to happen, right? I ordered channels by probability of error, and then, it's this ridiculous domain again, right, the interval domain. So it's time to ask the question that little kids like to ask their parents, where do interval domains come from, right? So the real line is continuous, okay, as a partial order, right? And approximation means strict inequality, right? So if every path 2y or beyond gets above x, it's because they're strict, okay? If they were equal, then you could get you know, to Y without getting above X. Now see, it's not a domain because it's not DCPO, right? But it's a really, really, really nice partially ordered set. And it's closely related to the domain, the interval domain, right? This is basically the one we keep running into, right? So here's a question you can ask. Suppose you begin with some partially ordered set with an order, right? What kind of structure does it have to let you construct an interval domain over it, right? So the point is, we want some partially ordered set that when we consider the intervals and we order them by reverse inclusion, they'll satisfy all the axioms, domains, right? Which is quite a lot of axioms. Now, this sounds like one of those problems you would ask a student when you just wanted to get rid of them, right? And just go, all right, just go do this. It's boring, but at least you're not bothering me. And the answer actually is not really so surprising. But when you see, in this case, it's the example that comes next that's really, if you say it doesn't surprise you, you're probably lying, right? So we start with a continuous partially ordered set, okay? So it could be like the real line. And we say it's bicontinuous if its notion of approximation is not biased towards soups. You see what I mean? Because there's two things you can say. Well, X approximates Y if whenever I get 2Y or beyond, I'm above X. Another thing, see, that's moving up. But you know, a good question is, well, why not define approximation moving down? Right? So just move 2x or lower, and then you want to hit below y. Right? Well, a post that is called bicontinuous, right, when approximation can also be captured in terms of infima, in terms of moving down. Right? This, and by the way, this turns out to be the statement in relativity that we can move up forward in time or backward in time.
Can you just repeat the definition of filters?
I'm not sure. Oh, sure, I didn't actually. That's because I didn't say what it was. Right? Yeah. All right. So directed means this. Filtered is the dual of directed. And so S, some set, whatever. It's, you know, it's got to be non-empty, by the way. In all these cases, it's got to be non-empty. So it's got to be directed. You have to be like this, right? Two things above, right? And filtered is the opposite. It's the dual. So if you have two things, then there has to be something below it, okay? And so what we want then, really, is because we don't want to get into all this abstract nonsense. We want to think of things. Here's the quintessential example of a filtered set, okay? It's a decreasing sequence. That's really what we want to think of it as. And you can prove in all the cases we care about that filtered sets can always be replaced with decreasing sequences. And directed sets can be replaced with increasing sequences. So the short answer is, it's a decreasing sequence. All right. And so a continuous poset, remember, approximation is defined using increasing sequences, right? Well, it's called bicontinuous if you can also define approximation using decreasing sequences, and it doesn't matter which one you use. So there's no bias towards moving up, right? Now if we have a bicontinuous partially ordered set.
Is a continuous poset a special kind of poset, or it's just any poset given the definition of the...
Yeah, so a continuous partially ordered set. So yeah, I probably went over that fast in the slide. So it's this. So you remember what approximation means, right? So we can remember that, okay. So then here's what it means. So P is continuous, okay? So it's this. When for every element, there are two things. So one, the set of things that approximate it is directed, right? It's directed. And the other thing is that it's soup. The approximations converge. See? You look at all the things that approximate x, they converge to x. Right? Directed means you can actually take the limit in the sense of the axioms. This means they converge. That's continuity. Bicontinuity is when approximation can be equivalently characterized using infima. And then you say, instead of the way lower set, right, you say the way upper set is filtered, as opposed to saying the way lower set is directed. You see what I mean? So you can do things either way in a bicontinuous partially ordered set. Now, by the way, when I said you're going to be surprised to see an example of this, right? If you look at these axioms, I mean, anybody who says that I'm not trying to rip off the real line with these axioms is probably lying, right? I mean, we start off with a continuous poset, but then we right away we say approximation is characterized with infima, and you converge downward on points as well, right? Now watch, it gets worse, right? By the way, and notice that this is true in the case of the real line, right? Because approximation in the real line is strict inequality. So if I want, I can say x is strictly less than y, if for all decreasing sequences that have a limit, whatever the limit gets below x, some number of the sequences below y. Right?
Can we say this way is bicontinuous if we use upward sequences to divide this x much less than y, and we use outward sequences, we get the same result?
Yes. That's exactly what it says, yeah. That's what it says. It says this, if you define it two different ways, using up or down, they coincide, right? And, you know, the infimum of this thing is filtered and is x, right? So you converge to something from above and below.
Just like left and right things.
Yes. Yes. All right. So we realize like this, but now watch what we do. Because now we can approach points from above and below, it makes sense to look at these intervals, right? You see, because now every point is something above and below. So we look at these intervals, and again, in the real line, what would these be, right? It'd be the open interval AB, right? You see what I mean? So now it really looks like we're just axiomatizing the real line, right? We take those sets, and by bicontinuity, you can prove they form a topology, all right? It's called the interval topology, right? Now we require
this,
something.
Another notation. This up arrow with two heads of x, that's just all the elements that are
way
in
above.
The future,
yeah.
Way above, as you call it,
mm-hmm.
chronologically above.
And yes. And I think you're really going to like this, actually. I have a really strong feeling. They didn't send you my slides, did they? No? All right. No, actually, that's right, because I didn't send them to him. Never mind. Right, it's my paranoia going. All right. So if you want these slides, like, I mean, really, I know that you're writing. Why don't you just take the slides? I mean, yeah. All right. So here, you can prove that this is the basis for topology, right, called the interval topology. All right, here comes the part where it looks like I'm ripping off the real line, okay? Now suppose you have a bicontinuous partially ordered set, and you say, I want these closed intervals to be compact in the interval topology. You see what I'm saying? No, come on. Now it's like, all right, the real line and its variance. I mean, now the rationals don't even work anymore, right? You know, you need the real line or like an open interval. I mean, right? And then here's the theorem. If you have a globally hyperbolic partially ordered set and you look at its intervals, then you get a continuous GCPO when you order by reverse inclusion. And here's a really important thing. If you look at the set of maximal elements in the Scott topology that they inherit from this domain, right, that topology is the same as the interval topology of the original partially ordered set. Right? So like, let's take an example. Say I take x to be the real line. Then I form the interval domain here. Okay. Then what it says is the relative Scott topology, when you restrict to the set of maximal elements, right, would be the same as the Euclidean topology on the real line. And this is always true for any globally hyperbolic partially ordered set. And the only problem is that we only have one example of a globally hyperbolic partially ordered set. You know, but if we had two, this would really be a cool theorem, right? So I'm going to give you an example of this now. So we take a time-orientable space-time, satisfying the chronology conditions and a whole bunch of things. So I'm going to draw you pictures of all these things. I mean, I think probably everybody in the room like knows this. So if you have some effect here, okay, then this is I plus of x, okay? And this is j plus of x, all right? So events that are right here, all right, are null intervals, means you have to travel at a speed of light, all right, if you're on the button. But if you're not, then, you know, a clock records some positive amount of time. That's what these two are. That's a picture of them, right? Okay? All right. And on a real line, I always give people this example just in case, right? It helps. Approximation means that there's a curve with a positive derivative that joins x to y, right? Which should make you think of this right here. And less than or equal to means joined by some curve with a non-negative derivative, right? All right. And now we assume that all spacetimes are physically reasonable. And this is taken from, anybody ever seen the relativity book with the Magritte painting on it? Like the table and the apple? Yeah? All right. Well, anyway, in there, it says that Penrose...
That's Wald.
Yeah, Wald, yeah. It says that Penrose it's my humor. I told you I could promote people. So in there they say that Penrose made the remark that globally hyperbolic spacetimes are physically reasonable. You know, and the reasons are like you can prove initial value formulations, relativity, all kinds of things like that. But I mean, they have wonderful, really nice properties. Right? So what does it mean to say that J plus, so that's this thing, right? It's like J minus, which is this thing, right, is compact. You see, in a picture, it looks quite reasonable, right? It doesn't have to be true. But that's what I mean when we say physically reasonable. We'll assume that, right? And then we define now the order to be Y as in J plus. So draw a cone, like with vertex X, and put Y in it. All right, that's what the order means. The theorem is, if you have a spacetime with a causal relation less than, right, then one, it's a globally hyperbolic partial limit set. Right, so remember that was like two slides full of axioms I showed you, right? Right. So it's a globally hyperbolic partial limit set. This part is super cool, and I got to tell you something that may be a historical fact. Approximation in the sense of domain theory means time-like causality. Right, this is domain theory. That's the statement from our domain. And the third thing is that the interval topology of this partial limit set with respect to this order is the manifold topology. Okay? So if you think of the real line, all these things are true, right? But here's the really cool thing. So the guy, the main inventor of domain theory, if you ask me, right? This guy named Dana Scott. He was at Oxford in the 70s when he invented domain theory. Right? And he used this symbol less than, right, to mean what I've written it to mean. Right? Then at the same, around the same time, like if you look at the date on Penrose's techniques in differential topology, he of course used less than for something completely different, time-like causality. Point is, they're actually the same thing. Right? So that's one of the things the theorem tells you, which is an amazing thing. And these guys, from what I understand, are also friends, so I don't know. But I don't think they conspired at anything. I mean, that'd be a bit far-fetched. But anyway, so we have an example of a globally hyperbolic partial limit set. That's not the real line, all right? It's what we call the globally hyperbolic space-time, all right? And then here's now we can do something. Let me show you why. If you take this space-time, we know you can make an interval domain out of it, right? Okay? And what that implies is that you can reconstruct space-time from only a countable set of events, using only causal statements, right? And so let me show you how you do this. So first, and I'll say something about the use of the word dense in a minute. But for now, let's just assume we take a countable dense set of events, right? Right? And then we have time-like causality. Let's do that first, right? The first thing we do is we put them in pairs according to whether or not they compare in this relation, right? And so we get all these pairs, right? And then on these pairs, we introduce a new relation, which should remind you of moving up in an interval order, right? Like this interval is contained in this one, right? We do that. Now, at this point, we get a thing in domain theory known as an abstract basis, right? The first thing you do with respect to that abstract basis, which is a set with this relation, so it's this set with this relation, is you form all ideals, right? Those are the directed lower sets with respect to this thing. You form them. Then you order all the ideals by inclusion, all right? And the theorem from domain theory is that you get a domain when you do that with respect to any abstract basis. If you now take this domain and you call it I of C, and then you look at a set of maximum elements in the relative Scott topology, the space you have, the space line, right? So here's the thing. Now some people, and depending on how you're looking at it, will say, well, you start with a countable dense set. You can't make that statement dense without knowing something about the topology. So what do you mean you're reconstructing it? It's not the point of this result at all, right? The point of the result is that space-time allows for that construction, that it can be understood this way, that if you choose the right countable set of events, then you can reconstruct space-time. See, and what I'm saying is, you know, we don't need this thing to be dense at all. We just take a countable set and its relation, and then we'll get something else. You know, is it a space-time? Well, that depends on the physics. I don't know, right? But what I'm saying is that the sort of universe that you want to be working in, it's somewhere in there. You see? And so the point is, that what we call a space-time today, right, it actually, you know, it allows for this description. This is consistent with our current view of space-time, okay? Then now, of course, there's another thing. Does global hyperbolicity, I mean, was this just luck, right? Or does global hyperbolicity actually capture something about causality? And I mean abstractly. Because remember, what do you need to define causality, right? You need geometry, you need differentiable structure, you need all kinds of things. We've ignored all of that. We just have these axioms, right? And so does it actually capture? So I want to show you why I think it does. Actually, this work is like, to some extent, an improvement on a paper, right, Sorkin. Right, right. No, it's really true. Right, so this is actually an idea in one of his papers, right? No, I put it together, right, thank you. Right. That's actually a good thing I didn't know. I would have been nervous when I was talking to him. Let's see if I can, like, stay not nervous. So here's the definition of causal curve with no geometry or anything, all right? So it's a subset of a space-time, all right? And it's compact, connected, and I mean those things in interval topology, all right? And linearly ordered by the order, all right? If you do that, then all you gotta do is just assign a parameterization, and that's where causal curve is, right? And then you can do this in any locally hyperbolic partial-ordered set, all right? You can define these things, all right? And then once you have a causal curve, you can define these to be the endpoints, and they're the least and the greatest elements in the image. Those exist by like compactness and stuff like that, right? So you can have this curve, right, with no geometry or anything, right? Now you can look at the causal curves that join one compact set to another, right? So they travel from here to here, right? And then the theorem you can prove is that the space of causal curves is compact in the torus topology, right? So to summarize it, right, you sort of take any globally hyperbolic partial ordered set. You can define a causal curve. You consider the space of causal curve. You can show it's compact and be a torus topology. And by the way, I mean, I didn't mention this, but I'm probably sure you know, this is a very important result in relativity. You need it for a lot of things, right? And these are some examples. There's actually a proof of positive mass theorem. Oh, it's him again, right? Okay, anyway, right. In the existence of maximum rank geodesics, like a lot of things, right? And it also identifies the mere torus topology as the way to topologize the space of causal curves. And I could explain that there's a domain theoretic reason why I say that. And just in case it means something, it sort of goes like this. In the domain of space-time intervals, maximal elements are events, right? Now, if we take the domain of space-time intervals, we can construct the convex power domain, which is this huge, ridiculous domain here, okay? If you look at its maximal elements, causal curves belong to there, all right? So that's like a very nice thing. Okay, maximal elements in the domain of space-time intervals, events. Maximal elements in the convex power domain of the domain of space-time intervals, causal curves, right? Now if we look at the relative Scott topology on here, we know we get the manifold topology, okay? If we look at the relative Scott topology on here, we get to be a torus topology.
That's very interesting, but what is the convex power?
That's why it's a footnote. We need a couple slides for that, right? Okay, so it's time to ask, what is global hyperbolicity? Like an actual, give me an answer to the question, right? Yeah, it's a partial ordered set, a lot of axioms, some cool theorems, space-time's an example, fine. So here's what's weird, right? You can prove this theorem. So we define an interval domain abstractly to be some domain that has a left and right function defined on it, right? So this would be like the function that if you give it an interval, it gives you A. Left gives you A and right gives you B, all right? And it satisfies a bunch of axioms that you would expect intervals to satisfy. I left them out because it's really a lot, right? Then what you can prove is this. The category of globally hyperbolic cosets, so that's the one where space-time lives, right, is naturally isomorphic to the category of interval domains, right? Now, in the proof sort of, this is more like a joke. I was just filling space in the slide, it's not a proof. But the basic idea is you take a globally hyperbolic partial ordered set. You build its interval domain. So you get the domain less than left and right. And then from this, you use all the axioms to take out the maximal elements and reorder them. And the point is that you can actually do that. So in the context of space-time, here's what it means. It means if you want, you don't have to think about space-time and causality. You can think about abstract space-time intervals, all right, with the inclusion order on intervals. And if these, in every sense of the word, mathematically are like equal, there's nothing you can't do with one that you can do with the other, all right? And another thing, just mathematically, that's very interesting about this, is like, so, for instance, it means the real line, right, is sort of in one-to-one correspondence, you know, with the integral domain over there, right? This is weird, and this is why, because these things don't have to be complete in the sense of order theory, right? You can move up forever and never have a supreme, right? But in here, you can't do that. You move up, and you have a supreme. And yet, it's a natural isomorphism between these categories. It's like, it's the strong one from category theory. And this is actually the underlying mathematical reason why you can causally reconstruct space-time. All right. Now, this is what Raphael was asking about. So what about measurements on the domain of space-time intervals, right? So a global time function is a function that's continuous and it's strictly increasing. And the inverse image of a point is the Cauchy surface. It means it's nice. You know, if you take a global time function and you measure, you know, an interval by looking at the difference in the times, right? Then you get a measurement, and the kernel is a set of events. See, that's the only way that this like delta t can be zero is if you have the same events. This corresponds to the Newtonian notion of time. Every event in space-time gets labeled what's on time. Okay. If that's your notion of time, you get a measurement. And what it means is that it's measuring the information content in a space-time interval, right? Now, this is like one of my favorite applications of measurement. It's like literally an application to time, right? So the Newtonian view of time gives you a way to measure the information content of an interval. Now, let's look at another function that is very naturally defined on the space-time intervals. That's the Lorentz distance. Right? Now, I don't know if you've ever noticed in books on relativity, right? But they'll say, well, if two elements compare, then the Lorentz distance is this. And if they don't, it's like whatever, infinity or something. You see, and the point is, that's just a little example of like how domain theory is so natural in this case. Right? What you really ought to be saying is, no, it's just a function defined on the domain of space-time intervals. That's really what it is. So if we write it that way, right, so there's the definition of Lorentz distance, right? It's the length of the longest geodesic that joins two points. The Lorentz distance is Scott continuous, right? And as a result of this, before we just constructed the manifold from a countable set, now we can construct the geometry, right? So let me show you why. We go back to the construction before. We have a countable collection of numbers this time, though, that we choose for each of these intervals. So every time things compare, in our causality relation, right, we assign a number. And we go, this number is the amount of time that a clock would record if it traveled from A to B. Call it that, right? Then we go through the whole, and by the way, when we assume that it's done in such a way that this map is monotone, this makes perfect sense, because what it's saying is, like, if you have an interval, so starts here, ends here, all right, but the time it records moving from here to here, all right, is longer than the time it records from some interval inside. That's what the monotonicity means, okay? And we know this is true in relativity because that's what it means to say the Lorentz distance is Scott continuous, right? The interval's smaller, the time recorded is smaller. So using all that, we go through the construction, right? Take the intervals, you know, build them, the formal intervals, take the rounded ideal completion. But here's what we do now for the numbers, right? We have this countable collection of numbers, right? And what we do is we go, okay, given anything in here, so that's some ideal, it's approximated by some principal ideal taken from there. So we look at those numbers and we take the infimum. Okay? So before, all I showed you was here's a countable set of events, here's how you reconstruct the topology manifold. Right? Now I'm saying, along with those events, give me some numbers that measure the amount of time a clock records when you move from one to the other, and here's how you construct some function on that domain. And here's what happens. If the countable number of numbers that you choose are the Lorentz distances, then when you reconstruct the domain, you reconstruct the Lorentz distance. Okay? And it's because this function, Lorentz distance, is Scott continuous. All right? Since it's Scott continuous, it's determined by its values on a basis. All right? So if you choose the right events and you assign the Lorentz distances, then you can construct everything, the geometry and the manifold. And so that's really the point. A countable set of events and a countable set of distances from those we can reconstruct both. And now what's really great is that the Lorentz distance is not a measurement, okay? And you can ask why. Here's one easy question. Remember, if the measure of something is zero, it must be maximal, right? Well, there are plenty of intervals, right? You know, like a clock loses the speed of light, right?
I hope this isn't coming later in your talk, but
actually, it is. See, I read your mind this time. Sorry.
You had to input a countable number of distances, and they all had to be the right ones to get the answer out. But the kind of construction that occurs in causal set theory, what you input is the some sort of volume.
You can do that too.
And you can do that more or less arbitrarily, and you get out a consistent, in general curve, but a consistent Lorentzian metric from it. So you've done that also?
Yeah, volume, like all those things, they all work.
But, I mean, the difference is that the volume is free data. You'll get a consistent curve, Lorentzian metric.
I was just sort of
whereas
like,
if you just input distances arbitrarily, I think it won't correspond to any curved or flat metric.
Right, so physically, it probably would be better than just the volume. There's an interesting thing that happens here. This function can't be a measurement. It is Scott continuous, but it can't be a measurement. By the way, the reason I'm interested in this is I like thinking about time. And I had a chance to actually prove a theorem about time. They're going to do this, right? So a clock traveling at the speed of light records no time as having elapsed, right? So these are called null intervals, all right? For that reason, there are things with measure zero in the sense of that aren't maximal, all right? So that's one reason it's not a measurement. There's actually a deeper reason, and I'm fond of this reason. So if we want, we can extend the integral topology to any continuous process. Remember, before we assumed bicontinuity. Well, we could just extend it anyway. Like, take those sets, and then for points that don't have sets like that, let's throw in some of these. All right. Anyway, if a function is continuous with respect to that topology, then we call it integral continuous. Right. So here's a theorem. All right. So Newtonian time and relativistic time are both Scott continuous, right? We already knew that, right? The Lorentz distance is interval continuous, right? But the Newtonian concept isn't, right? And then look at this one, right? If something's interval continuous, it can never be a measure. Because anything that's interval continuous assigns zero to any null interval. See? So that's it. That's a topological difference between Newtonian and relativistic time. One is interval continuous, and Scott continuous. The other one is Scott continuous and satisfies some other axiom, right? And I was very happy when me and Prakash did this. We were at his house all week. We woke up every morning really early. We just did relativity like all day long. We drank wine and watched tennis all night. It was a great week. Hi, Prakash, if you want. Some things we learned from this before I get to quantum is that causality can be studied using only domain theoretic ideas. So you don't need geometry or differential structure to understand or prove a lot of things about it. Okay? You can reconstruct a space-time manifold with its geometry from a countable set in a purely theoretic manner. I like this. Distinguishing between notions of time topologically. Remember, though, these topologies come from all this order, right? Otherwise, you wouldn't have it, right? I thought this was sort of ridiculous and kind of funny. The difference between the topology and geometry on space-time can actually be captured topologically, using a topology derived from causal relationships. That was weird. And this was actually pretty cool. I think we have a step toward a general definition of Lorentz invariants. Okay, and I think one of the properties that Lorentz invariants quantities have is that they're interval continuous. All right. So much for relativity. So, this is
since you're leaving, can I just ask one? Mm-hmm. I mean, in Newtonian theory, the time is a natural, a sort of canonical function. Mm-hmm. But in Aquarius, we know in relativity it's not. There are many time functions. Mm-hmm. So, does that mean when you go over to the interval language, there should be many? Mm-hmm.
There will be.
Measurements, and you don't really care which one you use, or is that a difference between the two?
Yeah, that's one of the amazing things. Because they're sort of like metrics, there are a lot of times where it doesn't matter which one, because they all like lead to the same topology. They have many, many properties in common.
If you were doing this entanglement, there might be many other measurements.
Well, yeah, there definitely are. As a matter of fact,
people argue over which one is right. So
right.
Should you say, well, it's just like a difference in the difference reference frame? And
it is a little like that. And like entanglement's a really good case. Like I can show you examples of problems, right? Where like, you know, if you want, you could like use entropy to reason about states changing over time. But you'd only do that if you were like, you know, a masochist that enjoyed being tortured, because formulas work out like ridiculous, right? And instead you can switch to really simple functions that like make calculations really easy. And that's like one of the things that happens a lot, right? So this is a set of finite probability distributions, right? I'm gonna tell you about something called the Bayesian order now. So if we think of a finite probability distribution as representing the information we have about the outcome of some thing that's about to happen. So there are n things that can happen. Right? And then suppose somehow we learn that outcome I is not possible. So we could say our knowledge improves to this. So this means xi isn't there. Right? So you take it out and renormalize. And then you get a bunch of partial mappings. And each one of these, it sort of tells you the information update that you experience when you learn that I is not possible. Right? And we call them the Bayesian projections. Using them, we can actually order like finite probability distributions, because this is what I'm now going to do. Right? So in the case of two dimensions, we could order one like this. Right? We could say, well, we can draw them this way, and we can say the least element, right, is this one, right? Means we don't know what's going to happen, right? The maximal element is here, and here, right? And where does this picture really come from? If we look at the graph of entropy, what we really did was just take it and flip it upside down and straight it out. Right? So this gives us a domain that we call delta 2. And the order is as drawn. This means you're moving up and up. See, again, uncertainty is decreasing. Okay? And it's ripped off from entropy. That's all it is. That's how we define it in dimension 2. All right. Now, how do we do it like in 3 or 4? So we say, well, suppose I know that observer 2 has more information than observer 1. And then suppose that they both learn that I is not the outcome. Then observer 2 still has more than observer 1. That's it. All right. And then that's the base case, like I said. That's the Bayesian order. All right. Now, about this two-dimensional case, you really don't have a choice in this case. There's a theorem which says, you know, there's a unique partial order on two states that satisfies the mixing law. So this says if x is below y, then any mixture of them is between x and y, right? And another way to think of this, actually, is that it requires depolarization. Classical depolarization moves down in the order. But in two dimensions, there's really no choice but a theorem. And if we do this, right, what do we get, right? Well, we get a DCPO whose maximal elements on the vertices, right? And whose least element is uniform distribution. What I want to point out to you is that this is very different from majorization, right? Because this is defined on all states, right? So like one of the things we sort of figured out indirectly is like, you know, we don't have to assume an order or anything. You actually get a partial order. And it satisfies the mixing law in all dimensions, and it has Shannon entropy as a measurement. Okay? Now, see, I didn't say it's a continuous DCPO, right? I said it's an exact DCPO. Now, so let me show you what this means. So, you remember approximation, right? So first I'll write what approximation means, right? So for every directed S, right, if y is below the sup of S, then some little s is above x, right? This is the one we use if we're talking about a continuous domain, right? All right, if we're talking about an exact domain, we do all the same, except right here, We have to change this to an equality, right? Okay, that's, then it's the same axiom, and then we still say this set should be direct and soup, whatever, and we get an exact BCPO. Now, obviously, while this was, you know, there's something you can do here. You know, you can write out these axioms, and they're a lot more delicate than the axioms of continuous DCPO. But you can obtain an order theoretic setting that general relativity and quantum mechanics fall into, right? Like, very nicely. This is not particularly well understood structure. So I decided to take a different path, right? So first, there's an order on mixed states that we derive from the Bayesian order, right? So this is state space, you know, this is a basis. This is a set of mixed states, omega, right? And these are the probability outcomes, right, when you measure observable E, right? And so what do we do? For every quantum state, this is...
Did you show us what the order was? Like, maybe you did, but I missed.
Oh, yeah, I did. Yeah, it's defined inductively.
I mean, did you show us in a concrete case, like...
In delta 2, I did, yeah. Yeah, and it's actually,
so what,
once you...
So what is the, yeah.
Oh, well,
what's delta 2? I mean, in a two simplex, you know,
right.
Thing.
Yeah, so these are the probability distributions on two outcomes.
Yes.
Right? And so this is the least delta.
Two, but I was thinking it's three outcomes.
Yeah, three is actually harder. Like, I can show you a little bit. But this, like, and when I say harder, by the way, it took us 50 pages to prove some stuff about it.
So there's no simple formula for what this.
Oh, there is. You want a formula? I mean, yeah, okay. I'll give you a formula in all dimensions if you want. Yeah? Okay. All right, so here's a formula. You're not gonna be happy. I mean, you know, but okay. So what does it mean? So it means that there is a permutation of this, you know, so some member of the symmetric group, and it has this property, right? Let me be very clear about this, actually. Okay, there is one such that one, all right? If I rearrange x and y, all right, according to this permutation, all right, they're monotone decreasing, okay? That's the first thing. And two is that for every I that's less than n, if I look at this, so I look at this and then I look at the ith component, okay? And then over here, I look at y and the I plus 1 component. That has to be less than x with the I plus 1 and y with the I. So one way to think about this is that it's saying that, quote, you can rearrange them so that they both decrease and that adjacent quotients increase. See? So you sort of divide by x and y, right? Okay, and so you look at x and you take the first quotient. That's got to be less than the quotient y. The next quotient x, and that's got to be less than quotient y. Somehow, you know, this is equivalent to this. It's 45 pages, pretty much. But
would you like a picture of it?
Not really. I can show you a little bit. Well, a little bit. So here's Bob, the least element, right? We do have pictures in our paper, though. Which we refuse to publish. You know, people wouldn't accept it, so now that they want to publish it, we said no. Very happy about that.
Did you send it to the archive or something?
It's somewhere on the web. So, all right. So here's one thing that happens in this order. You see all these regions, right? These all correspond to different permutations, all right? And if you take one of them, they're all isomorphic, okay? Like order theoretically, they're isomorphic. Then, if I'm moving along this line, I'm moving up, okay? I'm moving up if I go that way, I'm moving up if I go this way, right? And intuitively, it's because uncertainty is decreasing. Now, if I'm right here, then I'm moving up if I go this way, or if I go this way, right? I'm moving up if I go this way, I'm moving up if I go this way, or this way. That way is moving up, this way is moving up, and that's moving. Those are all up. Okay? Mm-hmm. And then roughly speaking, you do have some cones in here. There's a little catch though.
So what did that mean? So in you do have cones in the so there are basically like this diagram here.
Yeah. That's exactly right. Like this is a copy of delta 2. And what always happens is that the boundary of the one in dimension n is isomorphic
okay.
to the one below, which is a nice coincidence in the order of geometry, right? Yeah. And so that's what it looks like, roughly. I mean, those are all true, but one of the things that happens here, okay, is, and remember, we broke this order down because we wanted it to extend to mixed states, right? Majorization doesn't extend to mixed states. So we needed a property to be true, right? And what it was like, basically, if you had degenerate eigenvalues, right, that were, like, positive, right? So if you have, like, two eigenvalues the same for different, you know, outcomes, then we needed this to be true. When the spectrum of some matrix compared with this one, we needed this property to be true. This order has this property. We call it degeneration, right? But what it means is, like, if two probabilities in the one above are equal to positive, that's reflected downwards, right? Or another thing that's true is, like, if this one's on the boundary, then that one's always on the boundary. Is it when they compare? This is actually the stuff that makes this weird. Okay.
Oh, so you can't approach the boundary itself?
Yes, you can.
So, what you say?
Yes, you
said
can.
If y is on the boundary, then x is always on the boundary? Did you say that?
The other way.
If x is on the
yes.
boundary.
Yes. Right. So the boundary.
Once you hit the boundary, you stay.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So these properties are what make this order weird, and they all would kill continuity, believe this exactness to think about. But they're also the properties you need to extend the order to mixed states. Mm-hmm. You know? And when I say the order to mixed states, I'll show you exactly what I mean. Right? I don't know if this is the only way to do this. I actually hope it's not. I hope somebody here comes up with a better idea. We take a state, we look at an observable, we look at the probabilities, okay, of the outcomes. Right? That gives us a finite probability distribution. And then what we say is two mixed states compare, if only if there's some basis in which they're both diagonal and finite probability distributions for the outcomes compare in that thing, right? Now, if we do, that's called the spectral order. And if we do it, then we get the exact same structure we had in the classical case. We get an exact DCPO whose maximal elements are now the pure states, right? Whose least element is the identity. We still have the mixing law, and finally, an entropy is a measure, right? And things like unitary operators in the state space give you order isomorphisms on mixed states. And now, I'm going to show you a couple things you can do with this. So does anybody here care about classical and quantum logic at all? Yeah. I mean, it's like, I don't know. I mean, don't worry. You don't have to admit it or deny it. You know, but I, yeah. No.
Right.
Yeah. So I always thought this was sort of a cool thing. I don't know anything about logic. Actually, I shouldn't have said that. God, it's on the internet. I know a little about logic. Yeah. Anyway. So imagine that we're in a DCPO, right? And we call elements irreducible, which arise as the infimum of all the maximal elements above. Okay. So that's what an irreducible element is. All right. Well, if you look at the irreducible elements in that thing, okay, they actually give you the power set, all right, without the empty set. Because you'll notice there's no distribution that allows for nothing happens. So you have to remove that. And the quantum lattices also arise in the same way, right, the close-up spaces. And this is, so I think it's an interesting thing because it's like you have two domains and you have one way of deriving both logics. So this is about what they have in common. Right? Instead of what they don't, you know, right? Which I think is cool. Now, anyway, if people don't like logic, then they usually care about channels. So here's an application to channels, right? So if you take a classical channel, okay, that takes delta 2 to delta 2, and you know what binary symmetric means, right? It means it increases entropy or probability of a flip is the same. Well, you can show that any classical channel is binary symmetric if and only if it's not continuous. Right? And its set of fixed points is Scott closed. This is like a completely different way to think about what it means to be binary symmetric. Right? It's a structural characterization of it. And what's interesting is that it also works for qubit channels. A qubit channel will preserve the identity if and only if it's Scott continuous and its set of fixed points is Scott closed. And of course, we know from experience that unit qubit channels and binary symmetric channels are like very, very related anyway. Right? But here's a weird thing. I showed you before that there's only one way to order delta 2, according to that theorem anyway, right? Well, the spectral order is actually the unique partial order that satisfies those two properties, which are the same, and a third, which is that all unital channels are Scott continuous and have a Scott full set of fixed points. There's only one order on two-dimensional mixed states that will do that, and that's the spectral order, right? And believe it or not, there's actually something you can do with the Scott continuity of a unital channel, which I thought I would show you. So now we have formulas up. So if you don't like logic and structure, you probably like formulas, you know? I like both, actually. You know, I do. I especially love formulas driven by structure. That's like my thing, and I enjoy that. So, by the way, I switched to the block representation, and it feels really good to be in a room where I can just say that and not explain it. So I'm taking the two-dimensional mixed states, I'm looking at them on the block sphere, okay, and now this is the natural measurement, 1 minus the block, the magnitude of the block vector, right? Well, now, every unit of the channel we know is Scott continuous. It turns out that they all have informatic derivatives at every point except the identity, and it's given by this, right, which you can look at as like y over x. See what I mean? It kind of looks like y over x, right? Not only do they all have informatic derivatives, but the Halévy capacity of one is this formula. So this is the binary entropy. This is some number in the range 0 to 1, right? And so what does it say? It says that the Halévy capacity of a unital qubit channel is determined by the largest value of its informatic derivative, right? And in particular, that being symmetric, which in lots of cases they are, then you actually can just take the maximum of the magnitude of the eigenvalues. And then, like, a really easy way to calculate it. Of course, actually, making this so easy to calculate, like, it actually shows you that, like, I'm not really sure what Halévy capacity is supposed to be measuring. Because, like, if you take, like, a rotation, right, it'll tell you that, like, this thing is 1, right? The Halévy capacity of any rotation is going to be 1, which I don't like, right? But I have different reasons for not liking it, right? I mean, I have to think about them later, but basically, I like to think about the case where Alice and Bob communicate in the same basis. And in that case, you know, how would they discover what the rotation is that's governing the noise, right? You know, so.
So when you say channel, is that just an arbitrary, completely positive map between?
Trace preserving, Okay, so. There's another slide, it's going to get me in trouble. This used to be $1 million question. Then I found out it was only worth $925,000. So the question is there a way to reconcile...
In which currency exchange rate?
American, no, it's American dollars. Right? But I thought it was worth $1 million. I was lucky. It's a mystery to me how we assign these amounts to things, but no. All right. So, is there a way to reconcile the continuous domains of relativity with the exact domains of quantum mechanics? Right. So one thing we could do is we could write out the axioms of exact domains. You know, they'd be very complicated, maybe interesting, and okay, blah. I just decided not to do that. So maybe I'm not such a good mathematician. I don't know. I was thinking of another approach you could take. So here it is. Just as we consider the physically reasonable spacetimes, we're now going to think about physically realizable quantum states. Right? Now, I'm going to admit up front, I was definitely looking for a way to connect them. And so I found this way. And maybe this is a coincidence, but there's something unusually thermodynamical about relativity. This is a different approach. So we start off with a gas consists of a bunch of molecules, right? And you have different energy levels, right, for the molecule. You measure the temperature of the gas, and in the process, you observe the average energy, right? Now you ask, what's the probability that a given molecule is in state A sub I, right? Next, so the distribution there, right, you know, you get using the maximum entropy principle. So I want to look at this. So we assume that all these energies are different, okay? And you know, otherwise there's nothing to do, right? So we assume this. So what we know from strict convexity of entropy is that entropy has a maximum value. The set of distributions which achieve the observed energy, right? Actually, that entropy has a maximum value there, and it's unique. There's only one distribution in the set that achieved this thing. There's only one distribution that achieves the energy we observe. And that's called the maximum entropy state, right? And I promise you an example of an interesting fixed point. It's non-trivial. So I'm going to show you one. So using the energies, we define this function f, right? Then we define this function, I sub f. Then we define this function. This is not supposed to mean, it's just math. Right? We have all these functions. Then we use them to define an operator from the domain of classical states to the domain of classical states, this way, right? This mapping is Scott continuous in the Bayesian order, right? And this least fixed point, remember, which you get by iterating bottom, is the maximum entropy state, right? So you can literally think of it as like a process where you go, okay, initially I'll assume that all things are equally like. Then I apply this operator and my information updates. And then I keep applying it, right, until I calculate the least fixed point. And you see why the least fixed point matters? Because if you had another fixed point, right, the least fixed point would have greater entropy, right? And entropy's got a unique maximizer in the set of things that achieve, you know, the average energy, right? So that's why it matters. But anyway, so here's the step now, right? This is what saves demand theory, I think. The maximum entropy state has this form, right? It can be written this way, where lambda is a real number. Now look, this is the deepest part of the talk right here, because if you miss this part, it was all worth nothing, right? Then either lambda is zero, or lambda is not zero. Now, I'm not making it up. You'd be surprised how long it took me to realize this. Why does this matter, right? Okay, because then either if lambda is zero, those are all equal, and we're talking about this one, right? Okay, and if lambda is not zero, right, then all these things are distinct and positive, because the energies are distinct and positive when we started, right? So we call these the physically realizable states. They either have this property or it's uniform distribution, right? And here's the theorem. Out of all the physically realizable states, we're going to throw this one out because it doesn't teach us anything. And if we do that, then the domain of finite probability distributions is globally hyperbolic, right? If we restrict attention to the ones that the maximum entropy principle gives us, now we actually have a globally hyperbolic partially ordered set. And let me show you what the picture looks like, because it's actually quite an interesting picture. Like in the three-dimensional case, right, it looks like this. All right, you see these dotted lines? I'm throwing them out. Those are the six regions. I just threw out the dotted lines. If we do that in Bayesian order, then this thing is globally hyperbolic. So that means it has the identical order theoretic structure that space-time is. And in addition, if in the quantum case we just consider copies of interacting oscillators, right, we get the same result. The mixed states whose spectra belong to that thing over there are also globally hyperbolic, right? And now remember what we know about globally hyperbolic partially ordered sets. When you have them, you can make interval domains, you can reconstruct, you can do whatever you want, right? But it's absolutely like not an accidental structure, like global hyperbolicity, right? Because it's so hard to come up with examples. You know what I mean? So we have two examples now. We have space-time, we have mixed states, you know, as provided by maximum entropy, right? So I like to say it like this. This isn't meant to infuriate anybody, and the first thing here is a little bit, like you're on delicate ground if you go around saying things like this. I'm just looking for a nice, easy way to put it all in context. So I say it like this. Quantum mechanics limits our ability to extract information from a system. Partial information in the form of density operators, right? And that's what leads to this domain theoretic structure that we've seen, right? Now, in the case of relativity, what's limited is our ability to transmit information between systems, right? You can't move from like this event to like this one. You know, you must travel in the cone. And because of that, you arrive at a space-time interval, right? And that's partial information. And that also leads to this domain theoretic structure, right? That's what I see here. I'm not saying what it means, by the way, right? So maybe this is a principle, I don't know. So we can ask a question like, what happens when? You know, like if I'm holding an apple and I drop it, what happens, right? And physical law will tell you, like, if I do it right here, it's not going to move up, right? In general, it limits what's possible, and it provides us with partial information that can be used to explain what will happen, right? If we ask the question, this P happened and then Q happened, what path through space-time did we take? You know, if you ask that question, it relatively doesn't tell you that, but it gives you a diamond, It says, well, whatever you did, it was in there, right? So this partial information looks like it necessitates this domain theoretic structure, as I've tried to outline. So physically reasonable spacetimes are globally hyperbolic. And if we throw out the mixed states, you know, according to maximum entropy principle, then they're also globally hyperbolic. So I guess, you know, we could say we learned, you know, they have something in common. I'm not, you know, and I do think, like, this is sort of a good idea, that limitations imposed by law, right, give you domain theoretic structure because implicitly they make some statement, you know, about partial information. And I think probably I learned this the most. And yeah, I mean, that's it, you know.